have arrived at Friday. It's Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you think of State Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abrahamson announcing she won't seek another term? What about last night's debate between the GOP candidates for U.S. Senate? State Senator Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson faced off in Madison. What did you think of that? Join in on the roundtable, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in the analysis now with Chris Lotto here. He's a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Chris, welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And Joe Winicky is here as well, former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Joe, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Good to see you both. And I hear Chris has already had way too much caffeine today.
We'll see how that plays out. Well, here we are. It's filing day, 5 o'clock, the deadline for candidates to file nomination papers to get on the ballot for the state's August 14th partisan primary and November 6th general election. So we'll know who's likely in the race for governor, which Democrats didn't make the cut. As of this morning, 6 Democrats have submitted the paperwork. So Chris, starting out with you, what do you think? How is this shaping up?
Well, in general, gathering nomination paper signatures is really sort of that first real hurdle that you have to clear. I mean, everything is kind of a free ride up until then. And at this point, you have to prove that you have some level of support statewide to clear that particular hurdle. So I think that, this is going to be the first test of the, 17, 30, how many candidates are running for governor, Joe?
160.
There you go. And so the field will be winnowed down a little bit after today. But I mean, this is the first real hurdle. And in my experience, the state elections apparatus wants candidates. So even if there are challenges to signatures, they want to give folks the opportunity to correct those things and be on the ballot. So, after today, we'll know a lot more about how the picture is going to look for the primary season.
So, Joe, will all of the Democratic hopefuls make it on the primary ballot, or will this actually narrow the field?
Well, gosh, if you can't get 2,000 signatures in a couple months or of time, you don't deserve to be on the ballot. You'll see a bunch of people file today. I know there's at least 10 candidates that are going to be at the Democratic convention this weekend, which meant they had to prove they had 2,000. But they're just trying. They're not going to file till they have all of them. It'll be today, and my only complaint as a former chair of the party, and Chris worked for the party, is we're actually going to have one candidate on the speaking at the convention who isn't a member of the party.
Which
is
Mike McCabe.
Ah. Oh.
And the only reason I mention that is, how bizarre. I mean, so the Democratic Party, in its infinite wisdom, made a decision that their criteria to speak at the convention didn't include being a member. I guess what, Scott Walker can come in?
Well, it's just more of an open-minded approach, perhaps. So the Elections Commission is extending office hours to provide copies for challenges to nomination papers. Because of the weekend, the commission office stays open until 7 o'clock tonight, open 9 to 1 Saturday. So do you think there will be people actually examining papers, Chris Lotto?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the, cornerstone of opposition research and get 'em politics. I mean, I've been part of challenges. Mm-hmm. I have been working for candidates who did get challenged, and that's just a part of the process. And there are legitimate challenges that certainly I've seen in my experience, and there are some that are just frivolous and looking to cause a candidate trouble. But there absolutely will be a lot of combing over those papers in the coming.
What would
days.
Be legitimate?
I'm sorry.
What would be a legitimate type of challenge?
I think sometimes, I have seen in my experience people forge signatures.
Oh, yes.
And things like that, and forge addresses, and when you research it, I have been on these fact-finding missions where you look at an address, and this is before Google Maps and stuff like that, where we would literally drive out and say, okay, vacant lot.
Or there's 6 signatures with the same handwriting on the page.
And they didn't even bother spacing them out. I've seen that too. So there's shenanigans that go on.
What's on your mind, Joe, about challenges?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a big deal in the gubernatorial race. I doubt it is in any congressional races, too. Where you'll see it is like state legislature, where somebody will come in with 8 signatures or 12 signatures over the minimum number. And, of course, if the parties and the caucuses don't do that, I would hope the other candidate did. Because if you can knock off a candidate because they didn't even do the due diligence to get a lousy couple hundred signatures, you got a free ride.
So aside from the filing deadline, we and your comments there about Mike McCabe, we see these Democratic hopefuls trying to best their position among themselves going to this weekend's state party convention. So, Joe, what opportunity does that gathering offer candidates at this stage of the game, this stage of the race?
Well, first of all, at the convention, you've got people from all 72 counties. And so these are the hardcore Democratic activists, just as they are at the Republican Party. And if you can make inroads in some counties and some areas through your speech, through just glad handing, through your hospitality suite, through whatever, you may make some allies that want to help you that you didn't even know existed. And usually it's for the cost of a couple K for some beer, soda, and chips and stuff.
So for organization-wise, Chris Leto, are these conventions pretty important?
I think to Joe's point, I think he's right. It's really sort of impressing the quote-unquote elite grassroots, the ones who are really involved.
The faithful.
And who manage the county parties and things like that. And I think, you know, they are watching and saying, okay, because we have the summer county fair circuit and things like that coming up, parades and everything else. And certainly, I can't point to any specific examples, nor would I want to throw anybody under the bus, but I think you go to these conventions and you see, well, this candidate's here, this candidate's shaking hands, this candidate's making time, and I haven't seen this guy all weekend or this gal. So I think that's the kind of thing that you're looking to do at a state convention. And obviously, WisPolitics is doing their straw poll, so while it's not a huge deal in the grand scheme of things, and there's always, you know, opportunities to try and, you know, jigger the process or woo votes on site, that's, again, an early sort of indicator of where people's heads are at. So I think they view it in this sort of insular Democratic world as something that's important. You want to make a showing in the straw poll, and you want to be present at the state convention because that shows a level of involvement and that you want your party to back you.
And so, with all due respect to my dear friend, and he's a close friend of mine, Jeff Mayers, the founder of WisPolitics, the straw poll matters, but not as much as the press and the pundits think. Alan Cranston would be president if that was the case, and in Wisconsin at least, and that didn't happen.
Well, we learned this week that the state's longest-serving state Supreme Court justice and the first woman on the court, high court, Shirley Abrahamson, won't seek re-election. Other judges are already considering running for her seat. Voters will be choosing her successor in April of 2019. Chris, when should we expect to see people committed to running for her seat on the court? What will that look like?
I would imagine people are going to start staking their claim on that pretty quickly. And I think we've already seen a couple of names, one from the left, one from the right. So, I think they're going to move quickly. I think you want to, for a statewide race, you know, establish yourself as a candidate sooner rather than later. So I think we're going to see, you know, whoever's going to take it seriously start surfacing here in the coming weeks.
Abrahamson is 84. She joined the high court, Wisconsin Supreme Court, 76, first woman on the court, a liberal justice. So, Joe, what is her legacy and what comes next?
Oh, Shirley. I love Shirley. I my whole political career. Shirley,
is that your quote today?
Sure. I mean, okay. No, I mean, not literally, my whole political career, Shirley Abrahamson was on the Supreme Court, and most of that time was the Chief Justice. And one thing about even her detractors, because they don't like her liberal bent or whatever, could never deny the fact that she always did her homework. She was reasoned. She was principled. Yes, she was more liberal. But, you know, it wasn't just one of these people who are followers all the time. Shirley led. And she was a trailblazer. She was the first woman. She, I even got to understand her New York accent. But she is probably, in my opinion, 200 years, if they looked at Wisconsin history politically and said, who are the champions? Shirley Abrahamson's in that top 10 list.
Well, Chris, and what should people consider then for 40 years on the bench and as we look ahead at this court?
Well, to take a moment to give credit where credit's due, she was the first woman on the state high court. She served for in excess of 40 years, I believe, since, 76, I think the date was. So, I needless to say, I don't agree with her politically. I think her critics would perhaps point to her management of the high court as Chief Justice. We all remember from just a few years ago how contentious things seem to be amongst the relationships amongst the justices on the High Court. But clearly she has a record that, you know, deserves credit, deserves praise. I think she is one of those, you know, influential politicians in Wisconsin, kind of like a Tommy Thompson, one of those historic figures that, whether you agree with them politically or not, they, you know, they loom large in Wisconsin history. That said, you know, we do have currently a conservative leaning court in Wisconsin, but you know, it's not as strong as conservatives would like. So I think that that opens up certainly an opportunity for the liberal side of the equation to try and make some strides here in the next year.
Well, speaking of women making history, incumbent Senator Tammy Baldwin filed paperwork for her reelection bid just hours after Republican State Senator Leah Vukmir submitted hers, and they're part of a record-breaking number of women running for seats in the U.S. Senate. So, Chris, from a campaign standpoint, what does this influx of female candidates show us about today's politics?
I listened to your show of the last hour, and you had the person talking about female candidates, and I think it's a variety of factors. I think whether you look at the Me Too movement and Time's Up as sort of the instigator of that, I think I heard the point made last hour that while that may have driven more women into politics, that's not what's going to carry you across the finish line. That, okay, that's great that you're involved, but now what do you bring to the table as a candidate? But I do think that that is something. I'm sure it's a Trump backlash. I'm sure if you dive into the numbers a little bit, you're probably going to see a lot of Democrats in those numbers. I think an interesting race for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin is shaping up between Tammy Baldwin and potentially Leah Vukmir. I think that would be a fascinating race to see two female candidates for Senate in Wisconsin running against each other. Not to say that Kevin Nicholson won't be the nominee. Right. We'll have to see. But you know, that would be an interesting race. So I it doesn't surprise me. And I think that, you know, some of your callers talked about how, you know, we're more concerned about the content of character, what your policy positions are and what you're going to do in office than whether you're female or male. I mean, I would certainly subscribe to that point of view. I would, you know, it's the candidate for me, not necessarily the gender. But I also understand that it's an important moment for women and millennial women to see more females getting involved.
Joe, what are your insights there about more women stepping up?
I largely agree with Chris. I just say it's long overdue. I mean, women make up, what, 52% of the population in this country, and they're usually making up 15 to 20% of legislatures. It's not right. But, you know, Chris and I have, I've recruited many candidates over the years, and I've recruited many women, many men that have run for office when I was, like, party chair and when I was involved in the state legislature. It was always more difficult, at least in the good old days, and I don't mean this to sound sexist, it was always tougher to convince women to run because, in many cases, they have children, families, other obligations, and they couldn't position themselves in their mind that they could do this too. And men kept all the time saying, I'm ambitious, I want to do something else. And I'm so glad that's changing.
Well, to face off against Senator Baldwin, Leah Vukmir has to best fellow Republican Kevin Nicholson in the primary election. And the two debated last night here in Madison at an event hosted by the Republican Women of Dane County. Nicholson is embracing his role as a political outsider.
You have to be willing to break the glass, break the norms, do it different, and understand the urgency of a republic which is throttling towards a cliff.
And Vukmir says she's a proven conservative.
I've seen it. I've done it. I'll do it again. The stakes are high. The problems in Washington are great. We can't afford to take a chance on the unknown.
So, Chris Lotto, their policy stances didn't differ much last night. So what is the distinction going to be for voters?
I think certainly for a lot of the grassroots, you know, beyond policy, you're right. There's not a whole lot that distinguishes the two. But I think people are now going to start looking at backgrounds. And, for example, Kevin Nicholson has a background in the military. He's been very forthcoming about talking about being a Democrat and then turning, you know, becoming a Republican. And I know that for some in the Republican Party, they're not a big fan of that party switching kind of stuff. From Leah Vukmir's perspective, she does have the record in the state legislature that people can pore over and I'm sure pick apart. And I'm sure Team Baldwin is ready to do that.
Since 2002.
Absolutely. So there you go. And also she's, you know, Governor Walker's preferred candidate, and I think that that carries some weight as well with the grassroots and conservatives. So we'll have to see how it turns out, but I think it'll be an interesting race. It seems like Kevin Nicholson has sort of the early momentum going into it. They certainly, I think Nicholson seems to have a very organized campaign. I've been receiving, you know, lit from Leah Vukmir for months, so they're they're clearly both in it to win it. So it'll be interesting to see how things go this summer.
Joe, how about you? What do you think of the campaign strategy in the primaries?
When I stopped coughing, yes. I was just wondering what glass was Kevin Nicholson breaking? I'm not quite sure. That was in the quote.
Right.
He said, I'm not sure what that was.
He said, willing to break the glass, break the norms, is what he was referring to there. Do it different and understand urgency of a republic which is throttling toward a cliff.
Okay, a man who was a veteran is breaking seal idle glass. I don't know what his argument is, but that's fine. I don't vote in Republican primaries. They can do whatever they want. I think the bigger problem the Republicans have is in this world of Trump, and I was fascinated by something John Boehner said yesterday at the Mackinac Institute, where he talked about the Republican Party isn't there anymore. It's the Trump Party. And what's happening in primaries all over the country on the Republican side is they're trying to out-Trump Trump. And that's fine if people think that's where it's at, but I think that's very dangerous. And the problem I see, whether it's Leah Vukmir or Tim Nicholson, it doesn't matter to me. Vukmir's got actually a long conservative record that would be easy to attack. But from my perspective, they have to shift from August 14th to early November, 2 months, basically, and find a way to move from being this right-wing, and I don't mean this in a mean way, right-wing, but this almost ideologue to becoming much more in the middle, because you won't win way out there in Wisconsin. And I think it's going to be very tough for him.
We're combing through the week's developments on Week in Review with Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin, and Joe Winicky here at our side, former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to talk about the developments on Foxconn on Tuesday. An attorney representing a dozen property owners filed an appeal of a ruling dismissing their case that they won't be fully compensated for land. And there are rumblings that Foxconn's footprint may not be as large. Also, Wisconsin politicians getting travel expenses paid for by lobbyists. Does this money concern you? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings, back in two shakes here on the Ideas Network. Here we are starting off June, and it's our final week in review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The White House is imposing metal tariffs on some of our key allies, which may incur some retaliation there. Does this worry you? Wisconsin lawmakers getting meals, trips, lodging paid for by outside groups. Did this auditing of trips this week catch your attention? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Lotto stays with us, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin. Joe Winicky is a former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So now let's turn to Foxconn here. The rumors churn on as we watch Foxconn take more progress there in Racine County. Earlier this week, we had Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on the program. He had this to say to critics who embraced a report that Foxconn could be scaling back its plan and that the report Foxconn leaders deny. Here is Speaker Voss.
Well, it's frustrating to me that for so many on the left who hate the idea that President Trump is not always 100% successful with getting the facts out, to then take a report which the company and anyone associated with the project has said is not true and take that to be fact. It's really like commenting on, you know, things that just don't matter because it's not going to happen.
So, Joe, do you think that's a fair consideration for Voss to make?
Well, The whole Foxconn thing, $4.4 billion, the largest subsidy of a private sector business in American history, should be the number one issue in this campaign this year, and I hope it will be. But, you know, first of all, Terry Gou, whatever his name is, the chairman of Foxconn, would be committing completely political malpractice if he ever tried to reduce anything before November or whatever it is of the election. If I was Scott Walker, if he said he was going to start cutting back, I'd pull the plug on it. It's just bad theatrics. I don't know what's right. I don't really care. I'm more on that. I just think you got to get to why we gave away the whole store to Foxconn when our infrastructure on roads and bridges is just collapsing, while we're not funding public education adequately, while we're cutting back on the environment. Let's make that the issue. I don't care whether they may or may not build all their jobs.
Chris, before you jump in here, let's bring in Mark in Appleton with thoughts on this. Mark, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, this enormous cost of over $4 billion, and yet the unemployment rate is under 3%. I live in the Fox Valley, and in the local flea farm, I think they had 10 positions open. I was talking to somebody else at the mill. They had 10 positions. They only had 6 applicants, and only 2 people were worth hiring. I mean, there's enormous already a lot of jobs that are not being filled. So why are we spending so much money for Foxconn when at the same time the schools are hurting? The UW is in really deep trouble, and of course the roads are falling apart and the bridges are collapsing.
Mark, thanks for the comment. Chris Lotto, when we listened to Speaker Voss this week, he had a lot to get off his chest about Foxconn, making some points there, and also really being very critical of people who are downplaying that Foxconn could be having a smaller footprint in Wisconsin.
Well, I mean, look, Republicans in the legislature and Governor Walker, you know, spearheaded this deal, and now they have to go out in the coming months and defend it. I mean, that's basically it on the campaign trail. I mean, they are going to run into people who are active, passionate supporters of what's happening with Foxconn in Wisconsin and what it's going to do for the economy, what it's going to do for jobs. And there are those who, you know, blanch at the price tag and say, we sold the farm for $4 billion. And I think outstate that opinion probably holds. They look at the southeast part of the state benefiting and the rest of the state is saying, what about us? So it is up to Republicans to make a clear and compelling case for why they did what they did. And I think, I can't speak for Robin Voss. I wasn't there, but I'm assuming, you know, they're feeling the pressure to make sure that their messaging is tight, and the message they're taking to the state is this is going to help us. This is going to benefit the state. This is going to benefit economic development. This is going to bring more business and more opportunities at a higher level in Wisconsin, that this is the start of something big and something great for the state. But they have to make that case, and that's what you're going to see in the months ahead.
Well, we've also been seeing litigation coming from the Foxconn project. Tuesday of this week, property owners in southeastern Wisconsin filed an appeal after their legal case was dismissed, and they are arguing the use of eminent domain is unconstitutional and the offers for their properties are too low. So, Joe, how much weight should we put in the circumstances of these homeowners, of these dozen homeowners?
Well, I'm 1,000% on their side, and it has nothing to do with politics. The use of eminent domain was never really intended to just go quickly secure a private business to take a whole bunch of land in a given area, and then you ram it through and say, here's what we're willing to give you. I actually agree with them constitutionally. I think they should fight this to the end. But, you know, on the other hand, they're dealing with a multi-billion-dollar company. I don't know who's funding a legal suit. It's usually the big guys always win. But it goes back to until the cows come home, I'm going to be preaching to Democrats, run against this deal. Here is a classic case of David versus Goliath. Whether David is Foxconn or Scott Walker, or Goliath is Foxconn or Scott Walker, David is these poor little guys who by no intent of their own are being told to be dictated the terms of their life. And it's, can I say BS?
That's, why don't we keep it done at that?
Yeah. So I didn't go to the next level.
Very good. Very good for holding back. Chris Lotto, you know, what should we make of these holdouts?
Well, when you read the story, one of the things that they're upset about is that they got paid over the value of their property, but it wasn't enough, and that some that own a lot more made a lot more money. And so they're saying, well, you gave me, I think, what, 1.4 times the amount that's stated for my property, and I disagree with that. I have my own issues with eminent domain, and I think Joe and I are pretty close on that. But it was interesting, as I was reading the background on the lawsuit, and you see the federal judge that originally rejected their argument was none other than, you know, Lynn Edelman, who you can't imagine you would get a stronger liberal voice in support of these homeowners. And he said, and I'm quoting here, you know, the defendant's alleged conduct falls well short of shocking the conscience. So when you have Lynn Edelman saying that, then, you know, I think we'll have to see how it plays out with the appeals and everything else. Again, setting the issues with eminent domain aside, I don't know if they have a clear path forward in the courts.
Well, travel expenses came up this week for Wisconsin lawmakers under scrutiny. Reporting from USA Today Network Wisconsin shows last year, 50 legislators had meals, rooms, and travel costs covered by outside groups, including payments for some speaking events. The payments add up to $164,000. Joe, are you okay with that? What's
yes.
your takeaway?
Yes, I am okay with that. Often I've done, you go, you're asked to speak at a national group. I remember one time, I think I went to Las Vegas and spoke to the National Video Software Dealers Association, and I met the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It was very exciting.
Cool.
But you know what? It took days out of my life. I don't think they gave me an honorarium, but they did pay for, obviously, you know, the costs. But I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem if we get into the Robin Voss thing with the payday lender thing, but that's more about optics. But no, if a legislator is going somewhere and somebody's willing to pay for it, they have to live with that with the public if it's a group that the public may not like. If you
right,
went
but,
on Big
but
Tobacco,
where do you
for
draw
example,
the line? I mean, do you bring your family on this trip? Do you take an extended vacation
What always happened, at least when I was around, if you took your family, you paid for your family. You paid for your own airfare for your family and like, and if you stayed, that's on you. The other days, you're just talking about during that time. I think I took my family to Disney World once on a national conference state legislature's meeting, but we drove and there was no extra cost, and I had to pay the difference between the single room rate and the family room rate. I mean, I don't have a problem with this. I don't care if you're Democrat or Republican. Sometimes we have too pure of an eye on this stuff. And let the voter decide if somebody is taking largesse from a group they hate. Let them decide. Like for me, I wouldn't be impressed if somebody got funded or got to an NRA convention funded by the NRA because I don't like their positions. And I would use that against them at my personal voting. But that's how it should be done.
Chris, what do you think of this issue about concerns over travel paid for by lobbyists or outside groups?
Yeah, I would mainly underline, I don't necessarily disagree with what Joe said, and he obviously has direct experience that I don't have with that from being part of the legislature. It is not a Democrat issue. It is not a Republican issue. Obviously, Republicans are more in the crosshairs because Democrats want to take them out, and we do run the legislature and control. So, you know, we're going to be in the crosshairs, and then, you know, in a few years or whatever happens in the coming years, you know, then it's going to be the Democrats' turn in the barrel. I think if you want to criticize it more as a systemic situation and say, well, do we need to change the laws? Do we not feel comfortable with the way things are set up now? And also to Joe's point, it really is up to you as the voter to look at these kinds of things and say, ah, that matters to me, or no, it doesn't. I know the guy. I like the guy. I agree with his policies, and put this aside.
Can he give me a reasonable explanation?
Yeah.
Well, let's turn our attention to Washington as the world watches what's happening between American and North Korean diplomats. Top aide to Kim Jong-un is expected to hand a letter from the North Korean leader to President Trump. And we heard just this week Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying good progress is being made. Here he is yesterday.
There were decades into this challenge, and so one not ought to be either surprised or frightened or deterred by moments where it looks like there are challenges and difficulties, things that can't be bridged. Our mission is to bridge them so that we can achieve this historic outcome.
All right, historic outcome, summit on again, off again, on again. So lots of mixed messages. Chris, how can leaders politically salvage this back and forth that's going on?
I think this week with Pompeo's meeting with the North Korean official, I think that work is underway. So setting aside whatever the president is tweeting about in this moment, there is work going on behind the scenes to get this done. And I think that ultimately, you know, we, whether you're Democrat or Republican, should want to see something like this happen. This is potentially historic stuff. Now, we got to get the meeting done, which, you know, is still at this point, obviously, a question mark, because we're still talking about what might happen and Trump pulling the plug last week, but discussion's still going on. I mean, I just want to believe that it's going to happen, and this is the first step toward better relations, toward denuclearization, because the Trump administration has made it clear they want total denuclearization. Now, obviously, that can't happen overnight. That takes a long time for that. I think I saw a number, something like 15 years that it would take for full denuclearization to occur in the Korean Peninsula. But this is a step in the right direction, and we ought to be hoping that, yeah, let's get these guys to the table. Let's see what we can get done here.
Joe, can we gain anything from these leaders getting together, if they do get together in the end?
Yes, we can, and we also can have calamity. Normally, when you're dealing with something this contentious and this historical, and then you look at the track record of North Korea lying over and over and over again to the U.S. about commitments, that there's great risk on this. And my biggest fear, let alone the concept of Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un negotiating something, which scares the heck out of me, is that I keep hearing that Donald Trump wants to make history. You know, Nobel. He was quoting it himself. I think this guy wants to cut a deal to show that he is the kingmaker versus what is right for the region, what is right for the world. And what if he does it wrong? The guy shoots from the lip and the hip.
So as we segue here, trade making headlines as well as we talk about President Trump. At midnight, tariffs took effect on steel and aluminum imported from the EU, Canada, and Mexico. President Trump imposed taxes of up to 25% on steel and aluminum. And this morning, Ontario's Premier Kathleen Wynne said this on NPR.
We consider ourselves such close partners and allies with the United States, as we have been, you know, and this isn't how you treat an ally.
So as we've been talking trade and watching these negotiations all week long and for months now, Joe, are we entering a full-blown trade war?
Sure looks like it to me. I mean, let's see, what are we doing as of today? I guess it all starts today.
Yes.
We've already hit Japan, one of our closest allies. Now we're hitting Canada, one of our closest allies. It appears we've let Mexico off the hook briefly, even though it's got to have something to do with his beloved wall. And now we're taking on the European Union. So let's go after all our friends. And for what? So we can destroy Harley-Davidson?
So, Chris, what's your take on these trade decisions? As you see what's happening in Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe can't accept new U.S. tariffs on cars, saying basically no way, can't do, which could go from 2.5% to 25%?
I think with Japan, you're seeing this is a negotiating tactic. I believe that these are all negotiating tactics, and we can argue about whether it's the smart way to negotiate, but I think that's what's going on here. And certainly with Japan, I think there are some meetings coming up here in the coming days or next couple of weeks that I think this is the U.S. staking out their position, and then they're going to go to the table, and I think you're going to see hopefully something get worked out that is, you know, helpful to both parties. And I think, you know, it's interesting that in targeting these tariffs that went into effect overnight, I think Mexico, Canada, and the European Union, obviously two of them members of NAFTA, something that Trump made a lot of noise about either dismantling or radically overhauling it once he became president. He's been doing that since the campaign trail. So I think these are negotiating tactics. But again, not everybody's on board with it. The House Speaker Paul Ryan this week said, no, this is not the way that we should be doing this. We should be recruiting our allies to work with them. So while it is a negotiating tactic, and I think Joe, judging by his reaction, agrees with me, I think even Republicans are like, we're not sure that this is the smart way to do it.
And, you know, Donald Trump is becoming very predictable. This is the exact same tactic he did with North Korea. You know, let's do it. Let's pull it back. Then let's do it again. What's he doing with tariffs? I mean, you think these guys aren't smart? They're figuring out what he's doing. And maybe he's not such a great negotiator. I mean, the art of the deal was ghostwritten.
Well, but to your point, and I think that, you know, when you talk about the negotiation process for him, I think clearly you're right. A pattern is emerging. It's like, we'll do one thing, we'll back off, and then let everybody else work it out, or maybe nothing happens or something like that.
And nobody figures it out, right?
But that is, and we're still left scratching our head. I think that's the difference perhaps between business negotiations and political negotiations, where you're doing it on a world stage where everybody's watching you, and maybe some of the lessons learned in business you can't apply politics.
Hopefully the ones where he went bankrupt all those times.
Well, I have to ask here before we have to close in on a break here of commuting sentences. We've been hearing about the president expressing interest in commuting the sentence of disgraced former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich and Martha Stewart in the mix there as well. So what are you seeing there, Chris Lotto?
Well, first thing, I'm only going to say Blogo from now on because I saw you stumble across it and I don't want to deal with that. So let's start with D'Souza's pardon yesterday. Yeah. You know, look, the Obama administration went after him for a campaign finance violation of, I think, $20,000, where normally that would be handled, you know, with administrative fines or something like that. It was selective prosecution. They overdid it. They went after him. And Donald Trump, you know, obviously saw a wrong he wanted to right. As far as the others, I'm, you know, look, take a wait and see attitude on Blogo and Martha
Blago.
Stewart.
Blogo,
is it Blogo?
Blogo.
Blogo. You know, I guess on those two, I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, they're not the ones that I go, oh man, I wish Martha Stewart would get pardoned. She really got a raw deal. But you know, this is the world we're living in.
Joe.
It's,
I don't even know what question to ask.
I can pronounce Blagojevich, believe it or not. But here's the deal, and this is what scares me about this unilateral stuff, besides the fact that it's all tied to Jim Comey, and that's pretty evident, is that Blagojevich, I think Dinesh, whatever his name is.
Dinesh D'Souza, uh-huh.
They pled guilty. They admitted to their crime. So why is this a raw deal? I mean, they pled guilty because they saw what they were facing and what the evidence was. And now Donald Trump, I think, to send a message to Paul Manafort and all the others that, hey, I'll remember you too. And by the way, if he does this stuff, if this doesn't evoke a constitutional crisis where even Republicans say enough is enough, what's wrong with America?
We are moving through the week and what it brought forth on Week in Review with Joe Winicky. He's a former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Chris Lotto at our side here as well, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. You in the mix as well, 800-642-1234. President Trump joined in the public outcry over remarks by comedian Roseanne Barr that led to the cancellation of her sitcom this week, expressing his own complaints involving that. Should he have condemned Barr's remarks? We'll talk about that tweet, other national news, in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, you're with us for Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Reports spread this week that migrant children were being separated from their families at the U.S. border and that the Trump administration had lost track of nearly 1,500 kids. There was confusion. There was misinformation. There was emotion. Did you follow all of this? Did you sort it out? 800-642-1234. Our analysts stay with us. Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Joe Winicky, former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. You as well in the mix. 800-642-1234. What did you make of comedian Roseanne Barr's tweet that led to the cancellation of her sitcom this week, expressing and President Trump expressing complaints involving ABC. Should he have condemned Barr's remarks? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's look at this immigrant children situation. President Trump falsely blamed Democrats for a, quote, horrible law separating immigrant children from their parents. His administration had just announced the policy earlier in May, and the comments followed days of worry that federal officials lost track of these immigrant children, mostly from Central America. Some claim children being taken from their parents at the border, then getting lost. So, Joe, what's the role of our political leaders here? What's going on with this situation?
Well, Donald Trump is a megalomaniac with a messianic complex, as far as I can tell. I don't know if there's 1,500 children missing or not. I do know that some of this appears to be based on phone calls. Well, people who might have a family member or somebody that may not be legally in the country aren't answering the phone when the government calls. So it's possible that that number isn't relative. But when Donald Trump this week blamed the Democrats for this whole immigration mess, when it was done by his Justice Department at his request, and then saying he didn't do it, the Democrats did, is just patently false and outrageous. But I don't know. How many times can you use the term outrageous with Donald Trump?
Well, let's let Chris jump in here on the situation.
There's a lot more nuance to this than, you know, of course, in 140 characters, Twitter is, you know, Trump is the Hitler-Satan hybrid and is yanking kids out of their parents' arms as they illegally cross the border and making sure they're never seen or heard from again, which is absurd on its face. I think that the way the system is set up to track these kids is maybe something that you need to take a look at. I'd point to the Inspector General report from back in 2016 where they couldn't locate more than 4,000 kids under the Obama administration. So, I'm not to say that this makes it right, but I'm saying it's more systemic than, oh, it's Trump is evil and this is what he's doing. Now, that said, he is getting more serious about border security in the sense that, adults who are crossing the border are getting arrested. They're not being given a free pass. And in some cases, the kids who may be accompanying these adults are being put into the custody of HHS. They're being given to sometimes family members. And I read something where at times they're being given to family members who are in the country illegally, which makes zero sense to me. I don't know how you justify that. But then to Joe's point, they're not picking up the phone when HHS is calling to check on these kids. We don't know that exactly because they're still working on it. So we don't know what the real answer is. But again, this is it's a pretty clear-cut example of, if not fake news, there's a lot of obfuscation going on. And if you hate Trump, then this is the narrative you want to spin. But it's not necessarily the truth.
So what is the media's role here?
I think the media and the article that you all sent out beforehand, I think, is good because it walks through and explains the facts. I think that's what needs to happen is you cut through the BS. And now that Joe's gotten that word clear, I can say it, too. you need to take the time out, parse it out and figure out what's going on. Now, did Trump send out a dopey tweet? Yeah. Was it his first dopey tweet? No. Is it going to be his last dopey tweet? Probably not. But the fact is, there's much more to this than where are my children and, you know, Trump is yanking them out of parents' hands, because that's not the way it's going either.
Well, meanwhile, Roseanne Barr is retweeting support after she was fired from the ABC rebooted series Roseanne. The network canceled the show after she sent this racist tweet about an advisor to former President Obama. She has tweeted, though, that people should not defend her and apologized for the hundreds put out of work. So, Chris Liddle, starting with you, what stood out to you about this whole situation?
What stood out to me is why celebrities can't learn to put their phones down and not tweet. I don't get it.
Or presidents.
I mean, yeah, well, sure, yeah. I mean, I don't get what a Roseanne Barr gains by being on Twitter and sending this junk out. I mean, clearly she's got nothing to gain and everything to lose, because this show was, you know, the number one show on their network, is a huge money generator. They were leading with her in the last couple of weeks at the upfronts in New York, which is to impress advertisers for the upcoming season. So they clearly were ready to get into bed with Roseanne for a second season and beyond, assuming that the show continued to be successful. She just blew herself up with a dumb racist tweet. But, you know, I do think also when you look at this and you look at what happened with Samantha Bee this week, There is a bit of a double standard, and I think if you say there isn't, I think you're just not being totally honest. I mean, Samantha Bee, they know their audience. The network knows it. They knew in advance what she said. They beeped it out. You know, it's not like anybody was caught off guard that Samantha Bee said what she said. Exactly. So, she said she's sorry and whatever, whether she's sincere or not, I don't know. But, you know, that is the other side of the coin where reasonable people might take a look at it and said, what Roseanne did, absolutely awful. She paid the price for it. What Samantha Bee did, also quite awful. But, you know, we're not going to worry about that one so much because, you know, we like her politics and she hates Trump. So that means she's good people.
So, Joe, what do you think here in terms of how ABC handled this whole situation and whether, you know, where we go from here with such a racist tweet in this era?
Well, I think somewhat agree with Chris. If I was Donald Trump, I would have condemned Roseanne Barr, but instead he decided he was going to use it to condemn ABC about the slights against him, and he should have condemned Samantha Bee for an outrageous comment, and Samantha Bee ought to get the same action that ABC did to Roseanne Barr. You cannot have these people who are viewed in the public acting like complete morons, and nobody should defend either one of them, including the President of the United States.
So the White House has said that President Trump isn't defending Roseanne Barr, but is pointing out media bias. What do you make of how the president's comments are impacting the situation, Chris?
This is the wrong horse for him to ride. Uh-huh. I better he just stay out of it and just take whatever heat he's going to get because, oh, the president didn't tweet about it and didn't make his feelings. Well, who cares?
But he also didn't condemn her. And if he isn't going to condemn somebody who attacked his own daughter, he ought to. I would. I mean.
Yeah. I don't disagree. I think that I just don't see where, you know, you make that leap. He's trying to make his point. Clearly, he's not getting, certainly not getting preferential treatment. He's not getting favorable treatment. I mean, the media bias is clear and obvious. And I guess I wish in my heart of hearts that he would just accept that and move on as president of the United States and move on to other things. But clearly, this is something that really sticks in his craw.
Do you think that this particular situation will carry on, will hold in how he reacted? Will there be backlash?
I can't imagine any more than, I just don't, in the grand scheme of things, I'm not sure that the world is waiting with bated breath to see what he says specifically about
the
tweet.
He's being predictable Trump. It's how he acts.
Yeah, well, we will end it there. Chris and Joe, thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Lotto is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Joe Winicky is a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. And on this final note, the Week in Review is going on hiatus this summer as WPR reimagines the morning show. Fantastic news for you. Your new host, Carrie Kaufman, comes to the program on Monday. This means that this will be the final Week in Review, and now the team is taking some time to figure out how to best explore a variety of politics, including the topics discussed here on Week in Review as they go forward. So this hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina, Brianne Chasso, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network, and it's been such a pleasure sharing this time with you. Thanks for all your insights and this community here on the Ideas Network. It's very special. Have a great weekend. Carrie will meet you here in the chair back here on Monday.